Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, could a vacant tire factory in Hanford soon be producing some of the most advanced electric cars in the world? We'll learn what Faraday Future's announcement means, that it plans to set up shop in Kings County, both for the Valley and for the future of the auto industry. We'll also find out why the CSU system is changing its requirements when it comes to Algebra 2 as a prerequisite for taking college-level math classes. Some say the change is a civil rights issue. Others call it dumbing down education. We begin today's show, though, looking at the future of a Fresno landmark. One of the most recognizable buildings in downtown Fresno might have to close its doors. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports the first stopping point in downtown for many visitors could have to stop operation before the end of the year.
Welcome. We have cookies and punch.
It's a busy Thursday night at the Fresno Water Tower. It's Art Hop, the once-a-month celebration of local artists that takes place at galleries across the city. And the gallery in the tower is full of people checking out art from local artists that lines the walls and shelves. But there's trouble on the horizon for the distinctive building with its ornate exterior that could make this one of the last Art Hops. The Fresno Arts Council, which runs the gift shop and gallery in the city-owned building, says it is thousands of dollars behind what it needs to keep operating. The potential that the tower could close does not sit well with Sandra, who's visiting with a sponsor from the Big Brothers Big Sisters program.
I have never been in this building, but I think it's pretty sad that that a place like this would actually get closed, because I think a ton of people from an early age should actually come in here and start to learn about more of the history of their town and where they're from. I mean, it's their history and where they were.
The tower hasn't been a functioning water tower since the 1960s. Now it functions as a gift shop, gallery, and visitor center, welcoming guests to town as a gateway to the city's urban core. Alicia Zhang is the manager of the 109-foot-tall tower that was built in the late 19th century.
I think the fact that it's a historic building and it's actually open to the public, which makes it very unique, because a lot of places that are historic are not open to the public. They're always for private use. So the fact that there's a potential of it closing down just completely, I think it's a loss. I think it's a loss for the city, most definitely.
However, its second life as a visitor center and local artist gallery is in jeopardy.
It's been used in so many ways to represent Fresno. And it's unique, it's different, and it is kind of a major attraction for downtown.
Lilia Chavez is the executive director of the Fresno Arts Council. For the last several years, through gift shop sales and fundraising, the Arts Council was basically able to break even. But this year, a PG&E rate increase has thrown the math of running the facility into disarray.
The board has agreed to allow us to continue operating for 6 months to see if we can find a way to close that gap. If we can, we'll continue to operate the water tower. But without additional support, it's not likely that we're going to be able to close that gap. Which would mean that we would close the water tower.
The rate change means that the Arts Council is about $8,000 in the red. That's a big gap, since it costs about $19,000 a year to keep the water tower open for the several thousand visitors that stop by. Chavez says closing the tower would be a big hit to downtown, which has been the focus of ramped-up revitalization efforts, including the high-speed rail train depot and the Fulton Street reconstruction project.
Since so much of an investment is already being made in increasing the participation of people in the downtown area, this is just another important facility that we really need to maintain, and that's really why the Arts Council has agreed to continue trying to find a way to keep it open.
Chavez says they took their concerns to the city during the budget writing process earlier this year. However, no additional funding was included to balance the books for the tower. Mayor Lee Brand says he is aware of the challenges facing the tower, but says there are lots of needs in the city right now.
We will look at it. I have open to it, but I have this laundry list of other projects too. So, you know, it's on the list. We hope to address it, and that and many other issues too.
The Arts Council says they're considering all their options to raise funds if the city, which owns the building, does not find a way to help them fill the gap, such as looking for more community support. Back at the tower, volunteer Linda Bishop argues that closing the tower would represent a step back in the interest of revitalizing downtown.
There's great beauty in downtown, and we're revitalizing it, so why would we take one of our treasures and smash it or close it?
But without a new funding stream, the Arts Council says close it is exactly what they'll have to do. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It seems everyone in the auto industry, or as many now call it, the mobility industry, is looking to respond to all-electric automaker Tesla. Virtually every major automaker is scrambling to field competitors to the vehicles that have made Tesla the most highly valued automaker in the U.S. That includes major players like General Motors, as well as a number of startup companies like Faraday Future. With the backing from a Chinese billionaire and the state of Nevada, Faraday had plans to build a $1 billion, 1 million square foot factory near Las Vegas. But those plans now appear to be dead as the company has changed course and now has an agreement to lease the former Pirelli tire factory in Hanford. Here to tell us more is reporter Sean O'Kane with The Verge. Sean, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First, let's talk a little about Faraday Future and their product. I guess it's a little too early to call them actually an automaker at this point. What do they aim to bring to the market, and how would their product be unique?
So what Faraday has been talking about bringing to market in the next couple of years, anywhere from, you know, probably 2 to 5 years, is an all-electric vehicle with the sort of stats that you would expect to line up with the top of the competition in the field already. So, you know, we're talking somewhere around 300 miles of range, 0 to 60 in, you know, a ridiculously fast 3 or sub 3, maybe even seconds, and sort of things of that nature. But, and it's going to be some sort of a crossover SUV style, in the vein of almost kind of like the Chevy Bolt, but longer, somewhere between the Chevy Bolt and the Tesla Model X. But Faraday's taking a slightly different spin on what it wants to do with electric vehicles. You know, it's building in autonomous tech, just like Tesla or some of the other automakers are. But they're hinting pretty strongly, and even at some points have spoken outright about wanting to really change up the idea of car ownership. And, you know, maybe the FF91, which is the name of the car that they're making, you know, maybe it will be a car that you don't even own. It's something that you either summon to come to your house, or you, you know, pull up an app to reserve it at a certain time, almost like Zipcar. So they're sort of, they've thrown a bunch of these other ideas about car ownership up into the air. And we're still all kind of waiting to see which one lands once they actually get the car into production.
So who's actually behind this company? They have a backing from this Chinese billionaire. I understand they also have some former Tesla employees on staff as well.
Yeah, I mean, they've ramped up. I mean, they're an American-based company. They ramped up staffing pretty heavily once they came out of stealth mode in 2015. And they were definitely making headlines just for the talent they were poaching from places like not just Tesla, but Apple, and even outside the sort of Silicon Valley world. I mean, they've got a lot of really great talent from legacy automakers like BMW. But yeah, they have been able to make as many waves as they have so far, and hire as many people as they had, because they had a big chunk of financial backing from this Chinese conglomerate, LeEco, which, you know, does just about everything in China. They're doing everything from making phones to smart bikes to cars. They're the man sort of at the helm of LeEco is very interested in cars, to the point that he's, you know, even currently balancing maybe 3, I think, different car projects, including Faraday Future. And something that we've learned as Faraday Future has run into some financial troubles, because LeEco has run into financial troubles over the last year, is that this man who runs LeEco, Jia Yuting, he is very day-to-day involved in running Faraday Future and has brought a number of his own people into the company, has, you know, they put on a face that this company is still this American-made force to be reckoned with. But there's a lot of struggle that we've learned in our reporting over at The Verge on both of these companies, a pretty big struggle in the middle of that company for who's pulling it in which direction.
Again, we're talking with Sean O'Kane, reporter for The Verge. You mentioned some of the challenges that Faraday has had in its parent company or the companies affiliated with and major investors in Faraday. What happened in Nevada? We had this big plan for this mega factory in the Nevada desert. The state was behind this. And now all of a sudden that plan is no longer moving forward. What was it and what went wrong there?
Well, I mean, there's a couple different things. One is that, you know, Faraday was looking at building an entire factory from the ground up, and that includes everything from not just building the thing and not just building something that's a million square feet, but also all the stuff that you need to run a factory, something that hadn't existed before. So you're talking about laying water, power, all this stuff that, you know, you get to bypass if you can find a place that sort of fits what you're looking for. And I think that's why they wound up with this new deal in Hanford. But that was one of the big challenges, was just the sheer problem of building something brand new. And like you said, Nevada as a state was very friendly to this idea and has been very friendly to similar ideas. This is why Tesla is involved in building stuff in Nevada. And it is a state that is really trying to push this image of technology first. And they're really trying to inspire. There's, you know, self-driving truck permits. Daimler has self-driving semi-trucks testing in Nevada, for example. So it made sense that if Faraday Future really wanted to do this really crazy idea of let's build this Tesla-style mega factory, that Nevada would be home to it. But the problem was not just the struggle of building one from scratch, but as they were doing it, LeEco back in China, which had become essentially the main investor for Faraday Future and maybe even more, ran into its own financial troubles. They recently, in May, scaled back almost all of its American workforce. They had tried to make a pretty big push in the U.S., and it didn't really go so well. And so as they ran into financial troubles, so did Faraday Future, and that really sort of upended the project in Nevada. Faraday Future says that they're still holding a lease on that site in Nevada and that, you know, the plans technically aren't canceled, but they're certainly in more than an indefinite hold for now.
So why Hanford? Why that site there? This former Pirelli plant was a major employer in the area for years, but it's been vacant for a long time. Recently, there was talk about a marijuana operation setting up shop there. A million square feet is a big facility, but it wasn't an auto plant in the past. Why was this appealing to the company?
I mean, I think it's really hard to say for sure until we get a sense of what the actual terms of the deal are. I would imagine that that has played a very big role in their decision to go with the factory in Hanford. But, you know, I think it makes sense in a couple different ways in that they're already putting this messaging out of, you know, their headquarters is in the Los Angeles area. This factory basically halves the distance between Los Angeles and Silicon Valley. And so, it sort of fits the messaging of being this company that is, you know, tied to this idea of Silicon Valley new tech, but isn't really, you know, shoulder to shoulder the same with all these competitors. And so I think in that way, it makes some sense. California itself is just another state that is very friendly to green tech, new tech ideas. And so I'm sure that's going to help too. We do know that at this event that they held this past weekend, that there were city officials, government officials there. And so once we learn more about the terms of the lease, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there are incentives just like there had been in Nevada where they were trying to build their mega factory. So I think, and then, like I said, with the trouble that they had in Nevada building something completely out of scratch, the factory in Hanford at least makes sense because, you know, while it hasn't been used on the scale that it was used before Pirelli left in 2001, a lot of that infrastructure is already there. So Faraday's not going out and laying new water lines and building out electric infrastructure to be able to support the plant, that stuff is there. And that definitely takes a lot of the work out of getting the car into production after getting the factory up and running.
Is there some parallel here also with Tesla? They've received a lot of attention for the Gigafactory they're building to build batteries in Nevada, but their manufacturing facility that actually builds the cars in Fremont was a former Toyota and General Motors factory. Is there some parallel there also?
Yeah, I think Faraday Future borrows a lot of its messaging and even some of its planning from Tesla. I mean, and, you know, I think that's to be expected when a lot of their talent is coming from that company and companies like it. It is kind of funny to me that there is this idea that Tesla had helped not just popularize electric cars, but has helped popularize this idea of, you know, attractive, sleek, new factories that, you know, it seems like the most benign thing to be talking about. And companies like Tesla, but also companies like, you know, Apple and all the other sort of Silicon Valley giants, they take pride in these things. And so Faraday Future having great ambitions for a great big factory to make its car, even though even Faraday Future doesn't seem sure how many of them it wants to make, seems to fall right in line with the behavior of the kind of company that it's trying to position itself as.
Building a vehicle is an immensely complex, multi-year-long task. Prototypes, all sorts of development. The software behind this also is a huge component. What's the next step for Faraday? Now they have this facility outlined. Where do they go from here?
Well, the terms of the lease start in January of 2018. By that point, they'll hopefully have the place closer to ready to be to move in. You know, I think you guys out there might be more familiar with what shape it's in than I am. But I know it's been partially occupied sort of on and off since Pirelli left in 2001. But I would imagine there's some work to be done. But I think their goal is to get in the beginning of 2018, really get the factory into shape and start working on getting it really ready for production sometime probably in 2018 or 2019, excuse me. That's sort of been the target year for them for a while now of being able to roll some of the cars off the line. But I think, you know, we'll see them ramp up. But again, this is all really a matter of whether or not they can pull the money together. You know, LAECO doesn't seem like it's ready to be giving more money to Faraday Future because they're having financial trouble of its own. And Faraday's own executives have gone out and been very open about in the last couple of weeks about how they're looking for new sources of funding and how that process hasn't really been going well. I mean, they're looking, but they haven't really found it. And one of the reasons they were even able to close this Hanford deal in the first place is they were able to secure a $14 million rescue loan from an investment firm in New York. And they had to put their own headquarters up as collateral for that deal. So they've gotten to this point now, and they have at least a more clear picture ahead than maybe they did about a month ago when they really put a bow on the Nevada plans. But this is really all about money, and they really need to figure out where that money is going to be coming from. And then once that problem is solved, they need to figure out what's going on inside the company, too.
Reporter Sean O'Kane joining us today. He is with The Verge talking about the plans by electric automaker Faraday Future to set up shop in Hanford at the former Pirelli tire factory there. It could soon be building very advanced electric cars. That, of course, remains to be seen. We'll read more about that in The Verge. Sean, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. There are a lot of mysteries deep below California's Central Valley, but that doesn't mean what's going on below ground is out of the spotlight. From efforts to clean up water contaminated by nitrate to groundwater recharge, protecting the aquifer is a top concern of policymakers. But if the politics around groundwater weren't already hot enough, try mixing in what happens when you add oil production to the equation and what oil producers do with their wastewater. It's not a new issue, but as KQED's Lauren Sommer reports, there's still a lot that we don't know about the issue and potential contamination of protected aquifers from so-called produced water that's left over from the oil extraction process. Lauren Sommer joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Lauren, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You write that there's a lot that we don't know. This has been in the spotlight, though, for a while. What do we know about this issue so far?
Well, we know that the state has had a lot of problems in the past. That's pretty clear at this point. You know, essentially, the oil industry in California produces a ton of water, actually. They produce more water than oil, 19 times more water than oil. And so as they're bringing up the oil, they have to do something with all of this water. And so the state's program sets permits so that oil companies can put it into wastewater injection wells, basically big wells that pump it back into the aquifer or the formation underground, usually where the oil came from. Of course, you don't want that wastewater going into groundwater that's potentially usable as drinking water, protected water. But what we figured out years ago is that the state had problems for decades with some of these permits, and oil companies were putting some of this water into protected aquifers.
Now, this popped up into the news in a big way a few years ago with the news that the state and the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, a great Sacramento bureaucracy name there, was not potentially following the rules under the Clean Water Act. What has happened with that issue as far as enforcement? Has there been any accountability on the state level, on the oil producer level, since this initially came up a few years ago?
Yeah, so what the state has done is tried to figure out where these mistakes have been and what the problems were. They have identified hundreds of these wells or were in places, wastewater wells, that were in places where they shouldn't have been. And so they've looked through all the records trying to figure out where are the ones that they should shut down and where are the ones that they can allow to continue. And the state's still kind of in the process of figuring some of that out because there are hundreds of these wells that are in aquifers that are technically now protected. But the state says, you know, this water is so dirty, they shouldn't be protected anymore. And they're going through the process with the federal EPA to kind of remove that protected status. Now, they said they were going to have this done by February of this year, but there's still a lot of these aquifers that aren't quite resolved yet. You know, the DOGGR, as they're called, right, the Division of Oil and Gas, is said that they know that there were problems with oversight. They say that they're going through a renewal process where they're kind of reinvigorating their culture of enforcement and trying to figure out how to approach some of these issues. That's at least what they're saying at the state level.
So there are cases across the valley where the water quality in certain places, you go down deep enough, the water that's there is not very good. It's not something you would want to drink. But in some cases, these are what you call protected aquifers. And for some people, it's a real life story. You talked to one farmer in Tulare County, Bill Sammer, and what was his story and how does he fit into this equation?
Yeah, he actually had a really amazing story. You know, he has orchards up there like a lot of other growers in the valley. And there was an oil field kind of right near his property that was looking to expand. And so he kind of started looking into it, just reading up on it. And he discovered that this wastewater issue was pretty big near him, that there was a lot of water going underground and he uses groundwater on his trees. And it was kind of just because he has a son that works with maps for a living and has a pretty high level of GIS analysis ability that he was able to take these wastewater wells and then take a map showing where the protected aquifer was, and they were kind of mashing up these maps and figuring out that there was a wastewater well somewhere it should not be. It was in a protected aquifer, you know, near his property. And he sounded the alarm. He let some folks know, you know, there was a lot of skepticism and pushback. But eventually the state did figure out that this was one of those wells that was a place it shouldn't be. He was right all along.
So when it comes to people like him, what's the next step? You mentioned the state is trying to reassess and reinvigorate DOGGR, that division there, which is staffed by many people who have had experience in the oil industry. Is there some looming change in the future here? Is there a new enforcement that we should be looking to, or is it just a sort of a slow evolution?
Yeah, well, certainly one of the most important questions that people have, right, is, well, is anybody's drinking water affected by this? The state water regulators with the Water Board have looked into that a bit. They've looked at some drinking water supply wells where folks are getting using groundwater as their main supply that were within 1 mile of these problematic wastewater wells, and they have done testing in those cases. And in the good news is that they have not found any direct contamination that would really compromise somebody's drinking water supply. But, you know, what I was trying to do with this story was kind of ask, well, some of these wastewater wells were really injecting wastewater for decades into some pretty clean aquifers. And so I was just trying to figure out, well, what were these oil companies putting down there? And that was a really tricky thing to figure out. The state Division of Oil and Gas wasn't really able to produce those records because they said that they're in paper form only, not digitized, and they're kind of spread out among the regional offices around the state. And so, you know, when you talk to the Water Board regulators, they will admit that they don't really know what the net effect of this has been in some of these places where these wastewater wells were going for decades. That's something they hope to look at in the future, but they don't know right now what kind of painting, the entire story of this kind of massive mess up over the years.
Anytime there's coverage of the oil industry, people always bring up the word fracking, hydraulic fracturing or enhanced extraction from oil under the ground. Is this involving fracking or is this just conventional production?
Yeah, so this is conventional production. Kind of the way to think about it is fracking is like a very short-term event that the oil companies do prior to getting all the oil out of the well, and sometimes after, to kind of loosen things up a little bit. And so certainly there's been a lot of attention and regulations from Sacramento on the fracking stuff. This is different. This is just everyday normal production. You just get this much wastewater back. There is some wastewater that comes back with frack operations as well. But the vast majority of this wastewater is just from normal oil operations. But, you know, it's certainly an area that the federal EPA has come down on the state pretty hard for, saying that the regulations that govern this kind of underground injection of wastewater are lacking. And they did an audit 6 years ago saying that there were several areas that the state should improve its regulation and oversight to make sure that these are really secure operations. The Division of Oil and Gas says they are now working on new draft regulations, and I think they just have their first draft out now.
What does the industry say about this? Have they changed their practices in any way?
Well, you know, from the industry's perspective, they were doing what they were supposed to do, right? They were going to the state and saying, okay, we'd like to do wastewater injection here. Here's all our paperwork. Can we have a permit, please? And the state was saying yes. So, you know, there's been a lot of frustration on the part of the oil companies, certainly some on the smaller side producers, where, you know, they really can't run their operations if they don't have something to do with the wastewater. And there have been several where their wastewater wells have been in limbo or closed down. So fair amount of frustration there, right? Because they feel like they were doing everything they were supposed to and still have been impacted.
This may be a stupid question, but why can't oil producers inject their wastewater back to the same elevation from whence it came? If the water at a certain level that's producing oil is mixed with those hydrocarbons and things, is certainly doesn't sound like something someone would want to drink. Why can't they just put it right back at that same level? Or is that just technically not possible?
Yeah, for the most part, that's very common, actually. A lot of producers are at least putting it at a similar depth. Sometimes they're putting it back into the oil formation that the oil came from because it's actually kind of almost repressurizing, so to speak, that formation so the oil flows better. So that's actually a very common practice. It's not that oil companies aren't doing that. It's just that different places have very different geology, and in some places they were actually putting the wastewater somewhere else than where they got it from originally.
Again, we've been talking today with KQED's Lauren Summer. She is the author of a new report you can read online at kqed.org. How much drinking water has California lost to oil industry waste? No one knows. It's a very interesting story and the latest chapter, and one that I'm sure we'll continue to hear coverage on the California Report and on this station and KQED as well. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and find out why algebra is the latest source of controversy in the California State University system. A new set of rules out last week offers up big changes when it comes to algebra prerequisites in the CSU system. It also could shake up so-called remedial education at the CSU. We'll find out about that and more straight ahead on Valley Edition.
Hey, you listen to public radio. When it comes to public radio, membership matters. It's membership month, and if you listen to FM 89 and you're not a member, now is the time to show your support. Membership matters because your contributions keep NPR, local news, and your favorite programs on the air. As part of our summer fun drive, we've got some great thank you gifts when you donate. The ever-popular Be Public t-shirts, VPR barbecue aprons, and even Me and Ed's Pizza. Because just like Valley Public Radio, Me and Ed's is in communities all over the Valley. Now is the time to show your support. Membership matters. Click donate at kvpr.org. Thanks.
Tickets are now available for Valley Public Radio's $10,000 drawing. Hi, I'm Keisha Rajani with California Health Sciences University. We're excited to help sponsor your chance to win $10,000. Second prize is a cool getaway to Big Sur. Third place is a $500 Amazon gift card. Find more information and a downloadable entry form at kvpr.org. One lucky winner will be $10,000 richer.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. For years, the California State University system has had a requirement that students be proficient in intermediate algebra. Those who aren't have had to take so-called remedial math classes before they can enroll in other math courses required by universities like Fresno State and CSUB. But now that's likely to change following a policy issued last week from the CSU Chancellor's Office changing those rules. Here to tell us more is Michael Zinstein of EdSource. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So this policy from Chancellor White that was issued last week, what is the change here? Because we're talking about math requirements. They aren't eliminating the math requirement, but they are changing it.
They are changing the math requirements, and as most things in higher ed, the changes are complicated and they are dependent on other sets of changes. So actually last week there were two announcements. There were two sets of changes, one that applied to the kind of math that was a prerequisite for taking a college-level math course at Cal State, and then the other set of changes had to do with placement tests and the way that students who are behind, so-called remedial students, the kinds of courses that they'll be expected to take starting in 2018. So it's actually two sets of changes that are related to one another.
And it all has to do with algebra. Why is this such a hot-button issue at the CSU level, and why is this generating such attention across the state?
Well, it's generating a lot of attention because it's a national issue. It's been a national issue for as long as I've been covering higher ed. Algebra just ignites passion in people who teach math for a living and people who had gone through the academic system that basically said you need to know algebra to keep going. And so you're seeing a lot of passion from this, probably because a lot of folks had to do algebra, and when they see headlines that say changes to algebra or algebra requirement dropped, that just ignites a lot of passion because that's just not a trajectory that they themselves had to go on. But the actual change is this. This is the policy change. There are classes that students have to take at Cal State called general ed classes, and they're basically like these core classes that that students need to complete if they want to graduate from a CSU. The current standard is that no matter what math class you take, Algebra 2 is a prerequisite, so comprehension of Algebra 2. And Algebra 2 is the math that you learn in either 10th or 11th grade. So there's Algebra 1, which you learn in either 8th or 9th grade, then you take geometry in high school, and then you take Algebra 2. But for many students, even though they've taken the math classes that they needed to get into a Cal State, they haven't demonstrated proficiency. And so for these students, there's remedial math. On the specific issue of Algebra 2, the change is this. If you're going to take a math class and you're not pursuing a science or tech or engineering or math or business major, then the math class that you can take doesn't have to have Algebra 2 as a prerequisite. So some examples given to me are like statistics, perhaps even game theory, computer science possibly. The details are still being hashed out. All of this happened last week. On the Algebra 2 question, we should expect formal language to come out sometime this month, I'm told. That's important because if you're a high school counselor advising students on what to do, you want to see this written language. So if there are listeners who are high school counselors and they're trying to find the specific language, hang tight, I'm told. Sometime in August, the specific language will come out.
So what prompted this change? Are they trying to solve a particular problem or just make it easier for students overall?
They are trying to address a concern. And the concern is that for a lot of math, Algebra 2 may not necessarily need to be a prerequisite. So statistics, for example, statistics is hard. Statistics has its own set of rules, but statistics doesn't really have a lot of Algebra 2 components to it. No changes are being made to admissions policy. No changes are being made to the requirements for majors. But the thinking is, if an institution wants to create well-rounded students, should Algebra 2 be that prerequisite? And nationally, the conversation has been shifting toward, well, maybe not necessarily. And there are plenty of people who will say, yes, Algebra 2 is this really important gateway course that prepares you for a trajectory that gets you to calculus. And calculus is important because if you know calculus, then you can move on to the hard science disciplines or the math disciplines. You can major in science and engineering and what have you. And if somehow you take Algebra 2 out of the equation, there's this worry that students may not pursue a hard science. And the criticism of that thinking is, well, of course they can. They can take the math classes that they need if they feel compelled to pursue a science or math or engineering background. But right now, the worry is many students don't actually do well in their remedial classes. You have, you know, high dropout rates at these remedial classes. So there's this concern that there's this arbitrary expectation for students to be Algebra 2 ready when their choices for degree may not require that Algebra 2 competency.
So now there's another part of this discussion that's happening parallel to this, and that's an issue of civil rights. Chris Edley, who used to be the dean of the UC Berkeley Law School, has said this is a civil rights issue because of education equity at the high school level with the minority communities. What's the sort of the summary of that argument? And how does that factor into this discussion? Is this a direct response to those sorts of criticisms?
I don't know if it's a direct response. I mean, I think if readers are really interested in a document that sort of identifies what the core issues are with Algebra 2, then I would steer them toward something called the Quantitative Reasoning Task Force Report. I know that's a mouthful, but it was basically this task force that was created, and it was Cal State faculty and business leaders, and it's this roughly 50-page report that really tries to get at what an educated contributor to the labor force needs to know. Okay, and then weighing that against what all college students should know so that their opportunities for, say, a science or engineering or math pathway aren't denied. But on the larger question of Algebra 2 as a civil rights issue, one camp says Algebra 2 is not necessary for a lot of degrees. When I interviewed Christopher Edley, I asked him, did law students at Berkeley, and Berkeley is one of the most prestigious law schools in the country, did those students need to know Algebra 2? And he said flatly, no. they don't. And so you might have some of the brightest lawyers in the country who don't necessarily need Algebra 2, and yet Algebra 2 is being stressed as this prerequisite for taking a college-level math course. And so for folks like Chris Edley, and I don't want to speak for them, but if I can summarize the thinking, it's like, if Algebra 2 is not a requirement for a lot of disciplines, why is it a requirement to graduate? Why is it a not even to graduate, why is it a requirement to take a college-level math course? And others say, well, Algebra 2 is really important, and if you don't understand Algebra 2, then you're denying yourself the opportunity to pursue math or science or engineering or, you know, hard business majors.
I understand that a lot of the implementation of this is going to be up to the individual campuses and their presidents. How is this going to work out on that level? And then I want to ask you to follow up, what does this mean for CSU, Bakersfield, and Fresno State?
The short answer is there are many more details that need to be fleshed out. We just don't know. The timetable we were given is fall 2018, so presumably between now and then we should see a lot more activity. I know that community colleges before fall 2018 will be submitting courses that their students will be allowed to take that are transferable to CSU, so there's also a community college component to this. And so there's just a lot more detail that needs to be fleshed out. I do want to stress the second set of announcements from last week pertaining to placement tests and what remedial math and English will look like is important here. So one of the problems with remedial math or any remedial class is that even though students have to take them to catch up, they don't count as course credit toward graduation. And so one of the changes that's set to take place fall 2018 is that students, freshmen, who are deemed needing remedial math or English will enroll in classes that are college level, that they are credit bearing, and then these classes are going to have like these remedial components. So it's no longer the case starting 2018 where students will have to take one or two or even three remedial classes before they can reach a college level course. So that means that they would have to spend two or three semesters taking classes that technically don't count but still cost money. Now they'll be able to enroll in classes that are credit bearing but will still have these remedial components to help them catch up.
What's the scale of this problem like? Are we talking about just a few hundred students in the CSU system, or is this of a much larger magnitude?
So 45% of the incoming freshmen at Cal State Bakersfield need remediation in math, and 30% need it in English. So yes, it is a widespread issue. And so that's the freshman component. A lot of community college students require remedial math and English. Something like 50,000 community college students transfer to CSU campuses. At least that was the case last year. So the numbers that we're talking about are huge. They're large for the individual campuses. And yes, the individual campuses vary by what percentage of students need remedial math or English. But, you know, system-wide, it's a high number.
We've been talking with Michael Zinstein of EdSource about new rules announced by the California State University system last week that changed the Algebra 2 prerequisite requirement for some math classes required under general education. You can read more about it online at edsource.org. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listening to Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore. Last November, 64% of California voters approved Proposition 57, which allows for early release for so-called nonviolent offenders. Ahead of the vote, one of the biggest critics of the proposition was Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims, who criticized the proposal for the lack of specificity in defining how the law would be implemented. At issue, what exactly would be considered a nonviolent offense and what wouldn't be? Her criticism drew the ire of California Governor Jerry Brown, who backed the measure as a way of reducing the state's prison population. Brown essentially said, trust us, we'll work out the details once the proposition becomes law. Now, 9 months after its passage, those details are again back in the news. The draft regulations for implementing Prop 57 were released in the spring and are set for final approval in a few months. The Sacramento County District Attorney recently criticized the process in an op-ed in the Sacramento Bee, saying the state isn't giving prosecutors enough time to review cases, which includes those convicted of child endangerment, felony assault, felons with firearms, and other crimes. She even writes that a gang member was convicted of assault with a deadly weapon and is on her list of potential people eligible under Prop 57. So where does Prop 57 stand now in the San Joaquin Valley? Sheriff Mims joins us on the phone right now. Sheriff, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So from your perspective as a critic of this law before it became law, how do you see the process of implementing Proposition 57 playing out right now with respect to Fresno County?
Well, already on July 18th, there was a man from Fresno County who had been convicted of two counts of assault with a deadly weapon and sentenced to 11 years in prison. He has now been granted release by the parole board. So just 6 years of an 11-year sentence, and he is already going to be getting out. And he has a very violent history.
Now, I know you don't have the numbers in front of you right now. Do you have an idea of the number of people in Fresno County who are eligible in this first round of people who might go before the parole board?
I don't know the exact number in Fresno County. However, it's not going to be, as the governor said, that it was going to be nonviolent felons. This man, his name is Danny Ray Lucero, had prior convictions of burglary and, in fact, had one strike for one of the three strikes. So it's the message that is sent out as a result of this that people who are committing crimes are very aware of.
Now, I know district attorneys throughout the state are saying there's not enough time for local law enforcement and their offices to review these cases. Are you sensing a similar or having a similar concern with regards to how long you have to review these cases? Because I guess there's only 30 days to stage any sort of complaint.
That's correct. And even then, the purpose of Prop 57, from the state's point of view, was to reduce prison population. And I believe that's going to work. Our prison population will be reduced by releasing very violent felons right back into our communities, which not only strains the resources of local law enforcement, but it continues to create the issue of people going in and out of prison, which actually costs more money.
Now, I understand there's actually a bill in Sacramento that would look at redefining what some of these crimes are and how they are classified under the California Penal Code. Is this one of those issues that was just sort of under the radar, what's violent and what's nonviolent under the letter of the law before this and now has really rose to prominence? I understand there's a lot of offenses that people might think might be violent, but actually aren't. Things like assaulting an officer with a deadly weapon and inflicting injury on a child, those are currently not defined as violent. Is that something that you would like to see changed?
Absolutely, including domestic violence. That's not on the list of what's considered violent. So we really put this all in the hands of a parole board. And the governor had a lot of money. He had millions to help pass this proposition. And we tried very, very hard to get the message out that by saying these are only nonviolent inmates was not accurate. However, we just could not raise the money that the state had available to them to get the proposition defeated.
I understand there's also a nonprofit group out there that's filed a lawsuit suing the state, saying that nonviolent sexual offenders should also be eligible for parole. As I recall, the governor had said originally that this would not apply to those convicted of sex offenses. Is that something that you saw coming, or how do you see that playing out?
We saw it coming, and we tried to get the message out. The definition of what is considered a violent crime is listed under the penal code. Unfortunately, it's not all inclusive. And so that's why now we have the issue of trying to figure out, you know, what message do we send to the public? And technically, the legal definition is listed in the penal code, but it leaves out many offenses that you just mentioned.
Now, Governor Brown responded to that op-ed in the Sacramento Bee from the district attorney there, and he fired back saying, just because someone is on a list doesn't mean they're actually going to be paroled, pointing out that the majority of people who go before the parole board are denied parole. He also said that one of the people that she cited in her article as being on this list shouldn't have been there. It was some mistake. How do you respond to the governor's statement that essentially just because someone's on the list doesn't mean we're actually going to parole them?
Well, what the governor is saying is trust me. And the problem is, while we're waiting for these answers to come, crime in our areas are starting to inch up. And we keep hearing inmates saying and knowing that they can commit a crime and know they're going to get out early because of Prop 57. A good example is the young lady that was drunk driving and killed her sister while streaming it online. And online, she actually said, I'll be sentenced, but there's Prop 57, so I'll get out early. And that's the problem we face. How do we hold people accountable rather than continuing to let them victimize our communities?
Sheriff Margaret Mims, a consistent critic of Prop 57. We're hearing her remarks today in regards to the way that this is being implemented. As I understand it, this is still not finalized, but you're saying some people are already being paroled in Fresno County on Prop 57. Is that correct?
Yes. We already have one man who was sentenced in 2011 to 11 years. And in mid-July, the parole board voted to release him as part of Prop 57 standards. This is a man who stabbed two people. He had prior violent felonies on his record, and he had one strike under the three strikes laws. So this is a man who used a knife to stab two people, and now he's getting paroled back into our community.
We'll certainly follow this issue as it moves forward and also follow that effort to redefine what are, in fact, violent offenses under the California Penal Code. Sheriff Margaret Mims joining us today. Sheriff Mims, thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, that does it for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us your comments via email. talk@kvpr.org is our address. You can also tweet us at KVPR and at Valley Edition. You can find our podcast and audio archives as well online at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.